Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host David Bell takes the hour to talk with Mark Dupree Sr., prosecuting attorney for Wyandotte County, Kansas. They will talk about some of his priorities, a conviction integrity unit, how mass incarceration affects not only families, but the entire community, and why it's important for his office to be open and transparent. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, to David and his guest, Mark Dupree Sr.
Good morning. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. I am honored today to have a very special guest, Mark Dupree, here in the studio. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Many of you have heard of Mark, heard of his kind of rise. He was a former public defender, former prosecutor, and now the elected district attorney of Wyandotte County. And we're going to take the hour today to talk about a number of his initiatives and his unique background, which offers him a perspective on the criminal justice system that I think is well needed here today. Before we get into that, Mark, if you could just, for those of us that aren't fully aware of kind of your background and who you are, everyone knows your position, but who you are, could you briefly describe kind of where you grew up, where you went to school, and a little bit of work history?
Absolutely. Number one, I would like to say thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. It's always a pleasure to speak with the people and to make sure the community knows who I am and what I do. Grew up, born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas, Wyandotte County, true dot. I love the dot. And having done that, my mother and my father, the late pastor and co-pastor Dupree, they were pastors in the inner city all of my life. And so I grew up in the inner city as a pastor's kid. It was during that time as a young adult there in the inner city that I seen quite a bit of crime. And seeing this violence and seeing the crime and seeing death around me, I would oftentimes come to my parents and say, hey, what can we do? And quite frankly, their response was just pray. You know, you got to pray and ask God to help. Well, I later found that I can do a little bit more than pray. So I went to school. I became a lawyer. And after becoming a lawyer, and I started out over here in Jackson County, and I was a law clerk for Judge Gillis over here, and then moved on to the prosecutor's office here in Jackson County before jumping into the Johnson County Public Defender's Office, where I received a vast majority of my training as a criminal lawyer. After doing that for some time, my wife, Attorney Chanel Dupree, was so grateful to allow me, if I can say that, to join her practice, and we created Dupree and Dupree Attorneys at Law, where I was the only criminal defense lawyer that practiced there. And after handling criminal defense law for so many years, at that point then having dabbled in the prosecutor world as well as in the defense world, through a lot of prayer, I believe the Lord was calling me to run for district attorney. And then ultimately, that's where I ended up and decided to run. And for some odd reason, those great citizens over in Wyandotte County believed in the vision and elected me as a DA.
You were elected in an election in late 2016, and you've now been in office for about a year. Is that right?
That's right.
Before we get into some of your initiatives and some of your objectives in office, I want to briefly kind of talk about some foundational issues. And I guess the first thing is, what do you view your role as a prosecutor to be, the role of a prosecutor to be? I mean, obviously we have laws, people are going to break laws, but what is the role of the prosecutor in all of that?
Well, I believe that the role of a prosecutor, I mean, number one is the chief law official, right? So in my opinion, when I was practicing criminal defense work, I saw the job as a criminal defense lawyer and the prosecutor the same.
Yeah, and
that is that you're to pursue justice. And justice entails making sure that the right person who may or may not have committed the crime is the one that is given a fair trial. And so as the chief law official there in Wyandotte County, I believe that my job is to make sure that we, one, are going after the right people who are committing crimes, who are harming our community, who are putting our citizens at risk. And then once we get those individuals, then I believe it's extremely important that my office pursues a fair trial according to the Constitution, to give them their right to counsel, due process, and try to get a conviction where probable cause exists and where a jury having reviewed all of the evidence that's there. And so as district attorney, I see my job as one to make sure that everybody is treated fair. But then the other side of that is making sure that the community knows that there is no one in our community who can wreak havoc on our citizens and there be no repercussions. My job is to assist the police department in making sure our community stays safe.
And so, you know, in my personal experience as a public defender, now as a private attorney for a while, in my opinion, there seems to be only a very tiny group of individuals that belong in prison for long periods of time. It's a small group that create a lot of the problem. But so I think we all agree on that. If you're going to be a serial rapist, serial killer, whatever it is, those individuals, while their life is valued, it may need to be lived inside of four walls. What about the other individuals that commit crimes, but they're not going to be crimes we're going to lock them away for forever? What is your role with regard to those individuals?
Well, I think of my office and my team, we're focused on smart prosecution, right? And smart prosecution is not the lock them up, lock them up, lock them up. This hard on crime approach, which I absolutely say is a huge part of our mass incarceration situation that we have. Smart prosecution says not everybody needs to go to prison. Now, there are those, as you just said, David, that need to go, and they will. Those folks who refuse to obey the law and continues to put our community in harm's way, they need to be locked up. But there are those who smart prosecution says, let's look at the underlying issue, right? Let's look at this person who has a mental illness that every time they go off of their medication, then they go and commit a crime. And that crime is theft, that crime is burglary, because they're trying to feed their issue, or that person that is addicted to some type of drugs and have never had an opportunity to receive any type of treatment. It says, let's not just look at the crime, but let's look at the underlying issue, because a part of my job is not just to lock people up, but it's also to reduce recidivism.
Right.
And the numbers show that if we don't look at the underlying issue, within 3 years, the individuals that we send away for 2 or 3 years, they get out, and then they end up doing another crime and going right back because we don't deal with that underlying issue. And so what we've done in Wyandotte County is created a behavioral health court with the district court there to try to deal with the underlying issue of mental health. I mean, the numbers show that over 40% of, not just in Wyandotte County Jail, but across this nation, 40% of the folks that are in the county jails are suffering from a diagnosed mental illness. And that, to me, is way too high. That says that some of these individuals are not supposed to be in jail. We need to find out how we can help them. So this behavioral health court connects them with assistance. And through the courts and through my office, we connect them with organizations as well as mental health assistants there in Wyandotte County that can make sure that they're on the right meds, they have the right diagnosis, and so on and so forth. It's the same way with our drug court that we have over in Wyandotte County. And that drug court, through the assistance and the collaborative work with the district court, we make sure that those individuals who are in custody and or that come into the system because of an addiction and they were off of the right, if you will, medication. So they try to self-medicate, or they just have that addiction where they can't break. We give them that opportunity to get the help that they need before we try to send them to prison. So in my office, it's not a automatic go to prison. It is, let's try something different first. And listen, if you fail after being given an opportunity, mm-hmm. then my theory is prison is always there and we will send you.
But with regard to this mass incarceration, I know that's one of the issues that you've wanted to address in your administration. And I found it, I like the way you phrased it, at least I saw in looking up some background on you, how the concept of justice, when you look at it, is not only dealing with the crime itself, perhaps a victim, if it is, there's a victim there, but also the impact of the punishment on the community as a whole. And so I know something that it almost is like you're saying, hey, we need to take into account or take into the equation, what is the impact on the community as a whole if we take this individual, we incarcerate him, and then put him back out in the community? Is that a fair statement?
That is correct. That is correct.
And so how is that taken into account by you? How does that come into the equation? Is that more of a focus now in some of these prosecutions?
It is. It is. One of the things that we make sure that we do is look at, okay, how is this going to affect our community? But beyond that, what are we doing? How are we setting not just the community up, but how are we setting this defendant up? Because if we're sending this defendant away and we don't have anything in place that says when they get out that they will be a law-abiding citizen and will be able to assist this community in making sure that crime doesn't continue to happen and so on and so forth, then we're just setting them up for failure. And likewise, that means that we're down the road setting some citizen up to be robbed, to be burglarized, to be attacked by someone who comes out and now they have a felony on their record. Now they've been around hardened criminals for the last 3 years. Now they are connected to a gang and so on and so forth. And so all of these things come into play by looking at the defendant's history, to seeing if this person is already connected with some type of gang affiliation, if they have committed some type of violent crime versus some type of crime against our quality of living, and so on and so forth. And so all of that comes into play because it says, look, if it's a quality of living crime, maybe this person is not, all hope is not lost, right? Maybe there's a chance, maybe there's an opportunity. Or even if there was this was a person crime and he or she hurt someone, was this his first or was this her first crime? Was he or she connected to a gang? If not, well, again, all hope is not lost. And so maybe we give them some time in jail, but with that time in jail, let's look at the length of time. Let's look at the classes that they're going to have to take. Let's look at whether or not they're going to get supervision immediately, or they're going to have to take classes before they go, or they're going to go on the weekend, so on and so forth, so that we can tailor make the punishment to fit the person that fits the community. And so it matters because everyone doesn't respond to jail the same.
So let's talk about punishment for a sec. Being serious in asking this, what is the purpose of punishment? Meaning, do you really need to punish someone who breaks the law? And I ask that just as a very general question because we were talking last week, I filled in last week on cases that have made it through to the Supreme Court, and there seems to be this idea now of getting rid of the exclusionary rule, a kind of a punishment on the police, if you will, for violating someone's rights. They're kind of taking that away in terms of the ability to exclude evidence. And I was thinking about the analogy here on this side of it. If someone runs afoul of the law, does there need to be a punishment? And I guess internally I say yes, there does need to be a punishment in a way. But then sometimes after doing this for so long, I'm wondering what does punishment do, right? Other than to a three-year-old, perhaps, if you take away their, you know, video game or whatever it is, what does a punishment do to an adult that furthers my goals as a member of society?
Well, I'll tell you, and I want to be very clear on this. Yeah. The answer is yes. Right. Punishment is absolutely needed in my experience. And here's the reasoning, right? Because just like I say that different people respond differently to jail and to prison, it's the same way with different individuals out there. Some people are amenable to self-correction. Some people are amenable to correction with assistance, but some people don't care about correction. Some people don't say, you know what, I want to change my ways to help better the community. And with that in mind, then those folks need to be punished, not just for their crime, but for their unwillingness to change. And so in my opinion, punishment serves twofold. One, it shows the community that we're going to hold people accountable and that you cannot commit crime and go and receive a counseling session and now you can go back and it be at ease to do it again. So you're going to be punished. Two, it gives that person who is committing the crime a wake-up call, hopefully, right? A wake-up call that says, look, if you don't like prison, if you don't like the consequences of what your actions are bringing, then stop. If you don't stop because it's the right thing to do, then stop because you don't like the way that it makes you feel once we lock you up.
All right.
The fact that we're taking you away from your family, your job, your career, your whatever it is. And so I think both of those, just as we go down this road of smart prosecution, mm-hmm. and there's a place to look at that underline, I believe that there's a direct correlation as well with those folks who say, I don't care about smart prosecution, I'm going to do what I want to do, and jail and prison deals with that as well.
I really appreciate that answer, by the way, Mark. But how then do you factor in if some of these individuals are engaging in this behavior because in part of financial issues? And what I mean by that is in my own experience, and you indicated from where you've grown up, maybe you've seen it, there is an interplay, there is a correlation of some sort between crime and poverty. I'm not saying one causes the other, but I can tell you there appears to be a correlation, at least in based on my experience. So in some of those cases, aren't you fighting a much greater kind of social issue than you can handle as a district attorney?
I'll say that I think there is absolutely a correlation. I mean, there is no doubt, and I think any person that tries to argue with you, David, that there isn't a correlation clearly is not looking at the numbers and didn't grow up in my neighborhood. And so but what I would say is, yes, there are correlation, but there's still consequences. As a prosecutor, and I would even go back to my former defense lawyer days, and I defended quite a few folks. And I'll tell you, just let's talk about drug dealing. A huge amount of the clients that I represented, both in Jackson County, Johnson County, Wyandotte County, and all the way out to Shawnee, where I practice, their number one reason why they sold drugs, and they would tell me straight out, is, Mr. Dupree, I got to feed my children. It's hard out here. And I got caught the last time, and I got this felony, so I can't get this job. So I got to do what I got to do. And my response to that was, I have children too. And I just so happen to understand that it's hard out here. But the reality is there are rules and there are laws. And just because a person is dealing with some situations that we find, quite frankly, easily to be sympathetic to.
Right.
And oftentimes, not only sympathetic, but I can empathize
right.
with growing up in that poor neighborhood, with growing up and surrounded by the temptation of selling drugs and doing drugs and making the quick buck and not even selling, just carrying the packages for the drug deal. I was there. I understand it. But right is right. And wrong is wrong. And so, yes, there's a poverty issue. And yes, there's a economic issue that all comes into play there. But the reality is every man, every woman has to make their own decision. And at some point, we have to stand back and say, with all of the reasons, all of the excuses, all of the, what some would say, justifications of doing what you're doing, at what point do we say you have to abide by the law? And if we say that because my situation concerning my child, concerning my health, concerning my family is a justification for me to break the law, then we are setting ourselves up to be a nation of chaos, because it is law that assists us in maintaining some type of justice. Does that always mean order? Absolutely not. But it maintains a community that says you have to make the right choice or else there are penalties.
I'm just curious, based on your description of your life growing up, have you looked back and thought to yourself what permitted you or what allowed you to be where you are today? Obviously, hard work's got to be part of it, but you said that you saw individuals making these other choices. Why did you not make those choices? I'm just wondering if you can go back in your personal background and say, all right, it's because of this, this, and this, perhaps, that I am here today versus some alternative that maybe a friend or someone I knew who was younger, where they're at today.
Well, I'll tell you, number one is God. My parents who raised me in the church, I tell people all the time, and you hear a lot of folks who say this, that go to church as much as I did and do, I had a drug issue. And that drug issue was my mother and father drugged me to church on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So I was at church a lot, right? I was the janitor. I was the usher. I was the preacher, played the saxophone. And so the number one difference, for my life, quite frankly, was my belief in God and my knowing that ultimately that God had something in store for me. What I would also say to that is one of the reasons why it is extremely easy for me to make sure that I do the right thing, because I look at that criminal and I look at that super lawyer who has never committed a crime in their life, and I see them both as human beings. Yeah. Okay. I see them both as, you know what? They're both God's creation. And he made a stupid mistake and he made a good decision. But bottom line is, they're both people. And so I don't have this ingrained mentality of woe unto him, he's horrible, he's bad. One, because they're human, and two is because that may have been my neighbor when I was growing up. Right. That may have been someone I went to wind out high school with. And so I think number one is God. And then number two is my parents' involvement. I had both a mother and a father, and they were very involved. They were involved in my life. They was involved with disciplining me and all of my children, all of my siblings, their children, and it turned out well. And so though we lived in these neighborhoods and we didn't have the money that everyone else had, we had a family, and that was extremely important. I'll tell you one of the examples that come to mind. I recall when I first was in the Wyandotte County DA's office, I was there for a clerk back in when I was still in law school. And while I was there, I second chaired a preliminary hearing, which is the probable cause hearing in Kansas City, Kansas. And I recall going into the courtroom and my first chair, who was a deputy at the time, I was sitting with him, and the defendant who had allegedly shot someone walked in chains, and he looked at me as he walked into the courtroom to sit down, and he gave me the head nod, and the head nod is just nodding his head upward. And I looked at him, and immediately I remembered who he was. Yeah. And so I responded and gave him the same head nod, and the deputy district attorney looked at me and said, you know this guy? I said, yeah, I know him. And he went and sat down, and then we called the first witness. And the first witness was the victim who was shot. And he limped in, and as he got to the front of the courtroom, he looked over at me, and he did the same thing and gave me the head nod. At this point, you know, my deputy district attorney was like, Mark, how do you know these people? And I said, you know, long story, I'll talk to you later. And so he gets up there, and he does his thing, and then before we're finishing with this hearing, a young lady who's behind me taps me on the shoulder in the courtroom, and I turn back, and the young lady who they were shooting each other after, I knew her as well. And mm-hmm. She leaned up and said, hey, preacher man. And at the end of the case, after the case was done, about 30 people who were in this courtroom swarmed me. And the deputy district attorney thought he needed to call the sheriff's deputy. And I told him, no, we're good. And they came to me and said, we're so proud of you. See, what had occurred is all of us had went to Wyandotte High School, both the victim, the defendant, the girl that they were shooting each other after, and me. And all four of us were sitting in the courtroom in totally different positions in the uh-huh. courtroom. And so what it showed to me at that point, as both sides of this case all came to me, the victim's family, the defendant's family, and they said, we're so proud of you, because it brought honor and it brought respect to them to know that despite what's going on in their situation, there is someone that came out of this community that is standing on the right side of the law and who is doing what's right. And so what difference was made? And I think that difference was, we know that it's hard. We know that it's tough. And at some point, all of us shared the same classroom together with the same teachers, with the same principal. But we all made separate decisions. And each man, each woman, regardless of how hard it is, you have to make the right decisions, or else you'll find yourself sitting in the wrong spot in that courtroom, and it will be because of the decisions that you made.
We are honored today to have Mark Dupree, elected district attorney of Wyandotte County, with us as our guest. When we come back, we will talk about some more of his initiatives as he has finished his first year in office. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Now, the calendar for January 8th. The Kansas City Star will host a town hall on the secrecy in Kansas government at 7 p.m. Thursday, January 11th at Olathe City Hall. That's 100 East Santa Fe Street, Olathe, Kansas. All are welcome, but space is limited. Register before Tuesday, January 9th online at kansascity.com/secretkansas for a chance to attend. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, January 8th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or by email at redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, January 13th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MIST has members that may be able to help. One Stop Ministries is sponsoring Cookies with a Cop, Building Relationships One Cookie at a Time, Saturday, January 13th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Mary Kelly Center, 2803 East 51st Street, KCMO. This event is an effort to build bridges between the police and the Eastside community and is open to adults and children alike. For more information, call Gloria Smith at 816-337-1582 or email timesup2016, that's T-I-M-E-Z-U-P 2016 at gmail.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is David Bell and his guest, Mark Dupree Sr.
Good morning. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. This is David Bell, and we're honored today to have Mark Dupree, the elected district attorney in Wyandotte County. We've been talking about kind of choices in prosecution and then how to handle those, some of the values that are taken into account, not only in who to prosecute potentially, but also the punishments that they receive, also take into account kind of the harm to the community by taking someone in, incarcerating them, and then putting them kind of back into the community. I want to switch gears, Mark, for a second And I want to talk about the idea of looking back on perhaps injustices of the past. And one thing that you were in the news for significantly was the McIntyre case. And that was a case in which you agreed at some point during the hearing that what? Help me out here. What happened in that case?
So what occurred and ultimately what I end up agreeing with was that there was, in fact, some miscarriage of justice in the aspect of I do not believe that Mr. McIntyre received a fair trial. His constitutional rights to that fair trial, based off of my office's investigation and much of the testimony that came through that hearing, showed that there was, in fact, evidence that was never presented to the district attorney's office over 20-something odd years ago. And I believe that if that information and evidence was presented to my office, it is my hope that there would have been a different outcome 20-something years ago. And so what my office ultimately did is said, you know, because of the unfair trial and the lack of due process that occurred, we then decided to dismiss the case or ask the court to dismiss the case and allow Mr. McIntyre to get out and then refuse to retry the case.
Could you explain for our listeners, and I think because it's something that people have a hard time dealing with or understanding the criminal justice system, what is the difference between, if there is one in your mind, between whether or not you receive a fair trial and whether someone is innocent or guilty? Is there a difference there between the two?
Yes, there's a difference. And thank you for asking that question. So the difference is, again, going back to what my job is, right? My job is to make sure that, one, we get the right person, two, to make sure that our community stays safe, and then three, make sure that everybody that we gets a fair trial. And so with this situation, getting that fair trial is paramount to getting a proper conviction, okay? Getting a fair trial oftentimes means sometimes people are acquitted of crimes that they may have in fact committed. That fair trial says that there was not sufficient evidence to convict this person beyond a reasonable doubt, okay? Whereas, let's use the term exoneration, which is often used when a person gets out of prison. That term usually means that we believe that person did not commit that crime. And oftentimes this is brought about when there's DNA that pops on the scene years later and say, yeah, that guy was nowhere around. He could not have committed that crime. Therefore, he did not commit this crime. Or someone else jumps up and says, no, I committed that crime, not him. And so the difference is when we're talking about a fair trial and miscarriage of justice, we're not talking about whether or not that person committed that crime and whether or not
the
someone else did it. We're talking about, according
DNA
to the Constitution, that we all,
that
as lawyers, as this nation, as the prosecutor, has to abide by. And the Constitution says that we have to present all the evidence, that we have to give a fair trial to our peers and not withhold evidence, not hide evidence, not beat evidence out of someone. We have to do it this certain way. And if that is not done, then that process itself has now become contaminated and is no good for what we call justice in this community and in this nation.
And so what you're saying is if the process itself is contaminated, if it's been corrupted, at least it's that individual prosecution, that the product of that prosecution cannot be viewed as fair or just.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the McIntyre case, and I don't want to get into the specifics necessarily, but let's move then to other cases. I've dealt with a lot of people that have come back to me over time and said, David, I was wrongfully convicted. I was forced to plead guilty. My attorney hadn't done what he said he was going to do. We learned about new information later. How are you going to, if you are, going to go back and look at things in the past to determine if there are other individuals in a similar situation as Mr. McIntyre?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that we're going to do in starting this quarter, my goal is by the end of March, is to create what's called a conviction integrity unit. And this conviction integrity unit will be a unit within the district attorney's office that will review old cases, that will review cases that come to our office by letters, by the inmates, by different organizations outside the DA's office, and by the DA's office ourselves, that says, you know what, this was fishy. There was something wrong there. This conviction integrity unit, which I will say has been on my mind for about the last 2 to 3 years, but I will tell you that it was the McIntyre case that ultimately sped this process up to go ahead and implement this in our office. It has become a push throughout the country, Texas, New York, California, that district attorney's offices are seeing their job as not, again, as not just locking people up, but making sure that we have the right people. And so this conviction integrity unit will be composed of an assistant district attorney, potentially one or two. I'm not sure on that. Second, we will have an investigator that will do strictly with the conviction integrity unit. Likewise, one of the law professors from one of the local community law schools, as well as a couple non-lawyer volunteers from the community that will have the opportunity to look at these cases, review them, investigate them, and where there is undisputable evidence that there was a miscarriage of justice, that there was a contaminated case, or where, in fact, this person did not commit this crime, then this conviction integrity unit would then be able to turn their results over to me, and then I'll make a determination on whether or not that person's conviction will be requested to the judge to be overturned or not. And so the main focus here mm-hmm. is, here's the reality. In 2017, our communities and our criminal justice system has evolved tremendously since the 1950s, the 1960s, and so on and so forth. But we know, as lawyers, that there were some practices in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s that were absolutely unconscionable, rather or not it was constitutional, it was unconscionable, and it was wrong. And my thought, and many prosecutors and district attorneys across the nation who stand on this fabric of justice, has the mindset that how dare we stand and say that we stand for convictions and that they must hold integrity while closing a blind eye to the fact that we know in 1988 that this man was beat into confessed to a crime he was nowhere around.
Right.
So this gives us the ability to say, you know what, wrong is wrong. And even if it was done 30 years ago, we need to correct it if it comes to our door. Now, this is not something that we will go and search, but I'll tell you that with the McIntyre case, I won the election in November of 2016, and then I came into office in January of 2017, and this met me at my front door.
Wow.
And the previous administration had been dealing with this for several years, but had knocked it away and ignored it. And so there was no process to actually deal with the miscarriage of justice because, stereotypically speaking and historically speaking, many prosecutors desire to simply close their ears and close their eyes to it and say, you know what, I dare not say that one of my predecessors made a mistake. Well, we're all human. And God forbid I make a mistake,
right.
But I know I may. And if I'm willing to accept that I may sometimes make mistakes, how dare I not have a process in place to deal with mistakes that may have been made 20, 30 years ago? And so this conviction integrity unit gives us a process and an investigation to make sure that what we're doing is right. And here's the deal. We're talking about district attorneys, assistant district attorneys, and making sure that we're doing what's right and that we're not hiding evidence and that we're giving evidence to the defense bar and so on and so forth. And if by way of doing that investigation concerning that case, we find that there was also some misdeeds on behalf of other departments, then we will deal with that accordingly. But to ignore that there was a horrible discrimination and racism that embedded the criminal justice system 20, 30, 40 years ago, and pretend like now and everyone are equally seen as wonderful human beings, I think is wrong. And I think that is a miscarriage of justice. And so we're doing something about it.
And I agree, and I really appreciate that, and I agree with that. I will tell you my own experience. When you go to court to try to withdraw a plea or try to undo a guilty conviction based on a jury trial, it's usually, I wouldn't say easy, but I'm usually able to show something wrong in the procedure or what happened and how the defendant was treated, whether it was evidence being hid, something with law enforcement, whatever it may be. The difficult hurdle, an impossible hurdle, as frankly as I'm concerned at this point, except in rare, rare exceptions, is to be able to prove prejudice to the defendant. It's virtually impossible, and I find courts do not want to step in and overturn a jury verdict. And what I hear you saying is you were willing to go into that area that maybe a lot of the judges don't want to touch, and to say no, this isn't right from a systemic point of view. We need to do justice here, and we're willing to look and make the hard calls. Is that?
That is correct. That is correct. Which means sometimes it's very difficult calls. But, you know, my father, before he passed, he had a saying, and that saying was nip it in the bud, right? And ultimately, it's simple. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And as long as my focus is, was this right or was this wrong? Was this legal or was this not? Now, it makes it easy. But whenever the mind goes from what is right and what's wrong, mm-hmm. and we start veering off into, well, what is politically advantageous,
right.
or what is the best, what will the voters do to me if I don't appease them, then the waters get muddy. And I'll be frank with you that many folks that have held this position that I hold now have thought that way. And therefore, as even in the McIntyre case for years, did nothing about it. But I'm of the mindset, and Wyandotte County citizens who voted me into this place said, you know what, we are at a position where right is right. And we're tired of people just going along to get along. Let's do what's fair. Let's do what's just. And I'll tell you why. It's because the criminal justice system used to just touch a certain few. But now, with the opioid epidemic and the drug addiction and the mental health issues and how the justice system doesn't have something really adequate enough to really deal with many of these people, the entire community is now being touched. Someone's son, someone's daughter, someone's niece, someone's nephew that didn't used to be touched. And so now we're at a place where our community is saying, look, if we don't do what's right in the criminal justice system, it will and can have a direct impact on all of us, yeah. not just the guy down the block, but my next door neighbor, not just, you know, Mr. Jenkins in the other community, but one of my parishioners. And so they want someone who has integrity, who says, you know what? The person who committed the crime, lock him up. But if he didn't, let him go. And here's the other point. Why is that so important? Because for every person that my office pursues and get a conviction on that did not commit a crime, that means that person who committed the crime is actually still reaping havoc on my community, who is still harming individuals within our community because I chose to just get a conviction or a notch on my belt and focus on me rather than what is right, what is just, and what this community needs. And Wyandotte County citizens voted me in for that integrity, and that's what we're going to continue to push for. And I'll tell you that the community has been extremely supportive of this. The law enforcement has been backing it. Here's what I hope to find. I hope to find that this conviction integrity unit finds out that over 99.9% of the cases that we convicted still hold integrity.
Right.
But for me, that 0.1% is still enough that we say we still need to deal with. And so this is not to say that this is an indictment against the system. This is to say, you know what, let's make sure we're good. Let's make sure there's no issue. And everyone is on board with that because we take pride in what we do. We're careful. And law enforcement goes way above and beyond in Wyandotte County to make sure that they get the right people and that their evidence that they bring to us hold integrity. As Chief Terry Ziegler said in surrounding this whole entire McIntyre case, he said, we do things way different than they used to be. And I would agree with that. And so does my office.
And do you think that this idea of not just conviction integrity unit, but also just bringing integrity or making that a focus of your administration will get more buy-in from the community as a whole, and therefore will bring about, I don't know, people viewing the system, viewing government as something that they're a part of now and have to participate in, rather than viewing it as some kind of outside thing that they just need to avoid and get away from.
Absolutely. And that is the hope. I'll tell you that it wasn't until I went to high school that I even knew what the district attorney's office was. And even then, I really didn't know. And many people, as I knocked on doors throughout my campaign, didn't know what the district attorney's office was. The only thing that they knew about the criminal justice system was, what they saw on the news. And so what my office has done, not just in creating the Conviction Integrity Unit, but we've also created what's called the Community Liaison Board. And I stole this from a dear colleague of mine out in Seattle, and he has a little community liaison board for a specific amount of people. Well, I've created this community liaison board that covers from First Street all the way out to 142nd Street out in Wyandotte County, hence all aspects geographically of our community. And it composes of about 35 individuals in Wyandotte County that will meet with me quarterly. And when they meet with me, this gives me an understanding. One, the goal is to understand all aspects of the community, because what may be happening out in the eastern part of Wyandotte County versus the western part of Wyandotte County may be different, but I'm the prosecutor for them all. And so now we have a voice of the entire community there informing me and talking to me about what is happening. But the second part of this organization is to make sure that they can advise me on some of their ideas. I strongly believe that if one person believes that they're always right and always the smartest, then there's a problem. So I'm going to have 30 plus odd people in the room with me saying, hey, well, how about this? Because we are a community together. And quite frankly, not only as a pastor, but as someone who has grown up in this community, if a person feels invested and has a say in what happens in that community, then they're more willing to go out of their way to help their community. So my office is community-based. So we've created the community liaison board. All 26 of my attorneys in my office, they have to go out to the neighborhood watches, to the schools, to the nonprofit organizations. In this last year, not one of my assistant district attorneys have not gone out at least once to twice to speak with the schools, to speak with the organizations, to let them know what we're doing, and to focus on partnering with them to be proactive, rather than stereotypically speaking and historically speaking of the DA's office simply being reactive and waiting for a body to drop and now we're going. Our focus is, let's team up, let's mentor some of these kids. I have children and parents bringing their children into to my office just to sit down and shake my hand. Why is that important? It's important because they're knowing and now realizing that their children have an opportunity to become the district attorney, that quite frankly, at that age of 12 and 10, I never knew I had the opportunity. I didn't know I could be a lawyer, not because I was never told that I couldn't, but I never had a lawyer in my family. I had a lot of preachers. I didn't have any judges, right? And so when I was exposed to a judge, Judge Cordell Meeks, and he just so happened to be an African-American judge, that was my first time at 14 years old seeing someone in power who looked like me.
Right.
And so it gave me an eye-opening experience. And so my focus is, with our office, again, being proactive, is let's open the eyes of the entire community, because poverty is a real issue, whether you're black, yellow, red, or white. And many of these kids do not have that eye-opening experience to say, you know what, Mr. Dupree did this, I can do this. Or Mr. Jenkins did this as an assistant district attorney, I want to do that. And so we're going out of our way to help mold our new generation into being partners with law enforcement, to be partners with the criminal justice system, so that they can see themselves as judges, as doctors, as lawyers, as chiefs of police. I oftentimes joke with the chief of police over there that many times we go to these schools and I do these speeches and I corral them and get them all pumped up, and at the end of the speeches they're saying that they want to be the chief of police, and I say no. You know, I want you, I love law enforcement, but I want to be a DA. Yeah, yeah. And so it makes a difference.
And so, and I know one of the things you were talking about, and maybe this is part of it, the Conviction Integrity Unit is part of it, but is it more of a transparency in your administration? You know, what does that mean? I mean, I'm viewing like you're going to have a wall of glass outside your office, and I'll just be able to look in at all times to see what's going on. I mean, what actually does that transparency mean?
Transparency means that we will abide by the law, and that the community will be able to actually see us abiding by the law, because I'll be reporting it. Because I'll say, look, this was the facts, this was the evidence, and this was the conclusion. And there will be no question on whether or not we're doing what the law says. Quite frankly, a lot of people don't know what the process is because they've never been told. With this community liaison board, and many of these folks are neighborhood watch leaders, they are business owners, they are involved, and so they have, if you will, their own group of folks within the community. We will be going through the processes, right? What happens if there was an incident with law enforcement? What happens if there's an incident with a church? What happens when there's an incident with someone who's in political power? So that they can understand the process. And many times people think that things are going wrong, not because they're going wrong, but because they just don't know what's happening. And so my focus is simply educating the community on what the processes are so that they can know the due processes that are taking place. And this, in my opinion, will bring about that transparency because now they're educated to what's happening.
And once they're educated, once they see what's going on, and once they have some sense of ownership in the system itself, and they get more buy-in, and then that kind of feeds upon itself, I think, to more positive outcomes. It sounds like the final thing I want to talk about, we only have a few more minutes left, is we've talked about the current state of things, how you're going about in prosecutions. We've also talked about going back, if you will, this Conviction Integrity Unit. What about collateral consequences for individuals that are out there that didn't realize they were convicted of a felony, whatever it may be, that it would have severe repercussions? What is your office doing with regard to that? Is that part of a Conviction Integrity Unit, or is that something more with expungements, or how do you deal with that?
That's something more with expungements. Mm-hmm. And expungements being where you have the ability to erase those crimes or convictions off of your record. And my office, we have expanded since I've been in office, not only our expungement program, but our diversion program, which gives people an opportunity to not get a conviction, but yet make sure that they are accountable. So if they are out of trouble for a year, we then can dismiss the case on our diversion program. So we've expanded our program to give these individuals an opportunity, because I truly believe that passing out felonies like it's candy doesn't help.
And by the way, just not to lose business on my end, but do you need an attorney to get an expungement in Wyandotte County?
You know, at this point you do, but we're working it out. Hopefully within the next year you will not, so you can go about and focus. I'll tell you, my job would be very much more difficult if I didn't have law enforcement and the police department, the sheriff's department that partner with me and believe in me, and I believe in them.
I appreciate it. Mark, it's been a real honor. I knew you before when you were a private attorney briefly, and we passed in the courthouse, but it's been wonderful to hear your message and bringing kind of a new life into the district attorney's office. And I think it's something that we'll all look forward to. And I sure hope that maybe next year at this time, if you'd be willing to come back and talk to us again, and we could kind of see how things are going.
Well, David, if you call, we'll come. And I'll tell you, on behalf of the district attorney's office in Wyandotte County, we appreciate the service that you're doing. And I appreciate every person in my office that's fighting for justice.
Well, thank you. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. This is part of a discussion with George Carandinos, a PhD candidate at Harvard, talking about the dangers of fentanyl.
So heroin depends on the cultivation of acres and acres and acres of poppies to eventually concentrate down into heroin. And so there's been vigorous poppy eradication campaigns throughout South America under the pressure of the United States. What has happened is there's been a displacement to factory-based drug production, and the labs that are now in existence have increasingly supplanted the agricultural production. And so what you have is a tendency towards increased industrialization of chemicals. And so I thought it was really important to not mystify the fact that fentanyl is increasingly present and causing the damage that it's causing, and really understand it as just the latest turn in trend that we've seen repeatedly.
Well, George, thank you for that. Now, this brings to mind, we have this situation, well, let's reach back, what was it, 100, 120 years ago, the predominant use of opioids was opium itself. It was used.
That's right.
It was smoked. It was used in laudanum, I think, was the product that it was mixed into. I think a mixture of alcohol and opium. And the problem that we've created through prohibition, as you've indicated, sir, is that we've made it where people make a more powerful and, in truth, a more deadly product distributed around the country, and which leads to greater peril for the user and hell for our nation. Your thought, please.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the case. And prohibition, of course, pushes all drug use underground. It pushes people who are dependent on opioids, who could meet their dependence with any of the opioids, to instead purchase drugs from the street of totally unknown concentration and purity levels. And again, the problem with fentanyl is because it's so powerful at a small dose, even minor variations can be fatal.
Well,
and so the stakes of each injection has increased so much because of that. And it's not a result of the substance itself. It's a result of how people are forced to use the substance under the conditions of prohibition.
Part 3 with George Carandinos on tomorrow's show. This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.